Support for this podcast and the following message come from Lagunitas Brewing Company, challenging the status quo and crafting stories along the way. Featuring a wide range of innovative craft brews and non-alcoholic options, it's good to have friends. Learn more at Lagunitas.com.
Judy Blume's 1970 novel, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, was a staple of countless childhoods, but until now, it's never been adapted into a film.
Like the book, the movie tells the story of a preteen girl who moves to New Jersey, makes new friends, and waits for the arrival of her period. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Stephen Thompson. Today, we are talking about Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you. The day's top headlines, local stories from your community, your next podcast binge listen. You can have it all in one place, your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
Joining us today is NPR senior editor Barry Hardiman. Hey, Barry.
Hi there.
Also joining us is film critic and senior film programmer at the Jacob Burns Film Center, Monica Castillo. Welcome back, Monica.
So thrilled to be back.
It is great to have you both here. So for the sake of those who haven't read Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, or like me, haven't read it in about 40 years, it's a slice-of-life coming-of-age story about a sixth grader who faces some stressful changes in her life. In the film, which is set in 1970, Margaret is played by Abby Ryder Fortson. We meet Margaret shortly before her parents, played by Rachel McAdams and Benny Safdie, inform her that the family is moving from New York City to a New Jersey suburb. This upsets both Margaret and Margaret's grandmother, who is played by Kathy Bates. The movie is a pretty faithful adaptation of the book. Margaret makes new friends, nurses a crush on a boy named Moose, waits impatiently for her body to change, and tries several different religions on for size. Her father is Jewish, her mom is Christian, and Margaret has been raised without religion, a fact that comes up when she meets her mother's estranged parents. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret was written and directed by Kelly Freeman Craig, who also wrote and directed The Edge of 17. It's in theaters now. Monica Castillo, I'm going to start with you. What did you think of Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret?
So I'm part of this in-between generation where we weren't allowed to read it. Judy Blume was kind of banned from my library growing up in Florida. So this was one of my first real experiences of getting to see any of her stories. And I was so charmed. It is so darling. The cast is so impressive, and the story is still painfully relevant and relatable, even though it takes place in the 1970s. I loved it, and I'm so glad that it's on the big screen for a whole new generation to discover.
Nice. How about you, Barry?
I am part of the segment of the population that owns my copy still of Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. And so I went in with very high expectations and prepared to be disappointed. And boy, was I surprised, because I absolutely loved this film. It did a beautiful job at correcting a couple of things in the book that could stand to be corrected. It actually softened out some of the edges. The children in this film were masterful. There was not one child actor on the screen. It was all children. Rachel McAdams is so warm and lovely. I wanted her to be my mom. And Kathy Bates steals every scene that she's in. Again, this is a character that they've changed a little bit from the book, and sort of made her this sort of a mainstay of this particular family. And she just runs away with it. Again, this little girl playing Margaret is just stunning. What she's doing with her eyebrows and her shoulders is encompassing an entire world of sixth grade that I have a sixth grader. I see sixth grade girls and boys a lot. This was the most authentic thing I have ever seen.
Wow. All right. How about you, Linda?
Yeah, I'm afraid I have to just keep the train rolling. I also really loved this. I was somebody who read Margaret when I was young. It was already kind of an established classic book by the time I read it. What I really liked about the film is, just as Barry said, I think it maintains the integrity of the book, but also kind of adds to the book in some interesting ways. The building out of the character of Margaret's mother, mm-hmm. played again by Rachel McAdams, who's so good, I think does such a lovely job of explaining that in 1970, adult women were also in this position of, you know, thinking about who they wanted to be and how they wanted to fit into the world. And I think creating that parallel allows for some absolutely stunning scenes between Abby Ryder Fortson playing Margaret and Rachel McAdams. There's a scene late in the film where they're on the couch together that I just think is such a, there's so little dialogue. They trust those actors so much to just be in that moment. And it felt so genuine to me as a moment of bonding between Margaret and her mother. The other thing I would say is I'm so glad that they set it in 1970.
Oh, me too.
Because I think there's always a risk of trying to consider a story like this universal. And it's very important to treat it as a story that isn't universal. It's broadly relatable in certain ways, but this is one story of one girl in one place in one neighborhood. And I think leaving it in its moment rather than being like Margaret with a smartphone, Margaret with access to the internet, keeps the focus on the fact that this is what it looked like for one kid, you know, in this kind of family. And I think doing that preserves, in a lot of ways, the specificity of the story in a way that is more genuine than if they had tried to make it like everyone everywhere can understand this experience because, you know, kids everywhere wait for their periods and worry about their bodies. Like, right. But this is one girl and one girl's story. The last thing I will say before I stop prattling on about how much I loved this movie is I really respect the way they maintain the integrity of the story about religion. Because I think the fact that this is a story about puberty tends to dominate its legacy. And it is right there in the title, but it is a story about God. It is a story about a girl who is turning 12. And it is about her discovering essentially her entitlement to a relationship with God that is separate from organized religion. That's actually a pretty heady concept.
And radical.
Oh, yeah.
And radical in some ways to a lot of people. And you can easily imagine that being kind of sanded down for the adaptation that focused more on the friends and the boys and the bras and the we must increase our bust and all that stuff. I really like that they kept all the pieces, including that really complex story about faith.
Yeah, I also loved this movie. And I'm so glad I loved this movie, because if I didn't, I would suddenly be the guy who's coming in being like, well, let me tell you, ladies, why this story of a girl getting her period is wrong, wrong, wrong.
Yeah, but you've raised a teenage daughter.
I sure have. Mm-hmm. I sure have. And I loved this book as a kid, and I related to this book as a kid. I obviously from a different perspective, but I was a kid who was raised without religion and kind of went through some of this process of wondering kind of where I fit into the spiritual world. I did not think about it as deeply as Margaret does and did not address it as thoughtfully as she does. But I totally agree with everything all of you have said. I think, Linda, what you were saying about that great specificity creates a universal story really, really comes through here. I love how small this story is, how the stakes are really, really contained. And yet it is as big as any coming of age story. And I think that's really beautiful. I loved what Barry said about Abby Ryder Fortson's performance here and how much work she's doing with her shoulders. It really reminded me of how much I loved the movie Eighth Grade, which is kind of a similar kind of storytelling. It made me think about how Eighth Grade really has a debt to Judy Blume in ways that I guess I hadn't really thought about before. I loved this film. I guess my next question is kind of, how and why Judy Blume's stories haven't been translated into movies more often. I mean, it's sort of shocking, isn't it, that this book that came out 50 years ago is only getting its first screen adaptation now?
I think that's something that's somewhat covered in the new documentary, Judy Blume Forever. And it does talk a little bit about that. I think she was protective of Margaret and she didn't want, you know, multiple TV adaptations. There were previous adaptations here and there over the years of different books. I think Forever had one.
I think Tiger Eyes had one.
Tiger Eyes had one.
I love Tiger Eyes.
Fudge had a TV show.
Oh, Fudge. That was the one. But yeah, I get the sense that this one, which was, I think, one of her first breakout, if not her first breakout, she wanted to hold on a little bit longer. And then now there seems like a little Judy Blume revival. And it especially kind of stands out to me because in the documentary, she also talks about like the book censorship and how that's come back around. And especially, you know, someone who did grow up in Florida and wasn't allowed to read her books because the school librarian deemed it too adult for us. Mm. That is continuing, that thing that she's been fighting for decades now. And that's kind of interesting that other forms of media are kind of combating that in a way between the documentary and between this movie adaptation makes it more accessible for people.
You know, I also think, you know, all of that is true, but we also have really focused on the kinds of coming of age stories that are more dangerous than this one. Do you know what I mean? Like the ones where there maybe isn't a loving family. And those are, by the way, important adaptations as well. But I think that what often, you know, I'm thinking of the movie 13, you know, with Evan Rachel Wood. And there's a kind of like, you don't know how bad it is film that kind of rose to the forefront. And in some ways, it sort of squeezed out what one hopes is the ideal, really, experience for young girls. But it also, I think some of it is that, you know, not much happens in this film. I mean, one thing, like you look at the plot architecture, not much happens. You know, spoiler alert, she does, you know, get her period. But, you know, it's a series of sort of smaller stories about relationships with God, relationships with your family, relationships with your friends. And apart from the Babysitter's Club, which, by the way, this has a lot in common with the adaptation of the Babysitter's Club on television, which was canceled for, I'll never get over it. But, you know, I think, again, like this is a small story. And, you know, there's still so much sort of hyperventilating and in some ways with good reason about how dangerous it is to be a kid. There's a lot more warning than there is than celebrating. And this is a celebrator, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also think that one thing about this film is that Abby Ryder Fortson just turned 15. So she was 14 when they filmed this, which is much closer to an actual turning 12-year-old than Hollywood will often give you.
Yeah.
I think one thing that has happened is there has been more interest when you're making coming-of-age stories. There has been more interest in a little bit later teenagers, like the Stranger Things stuff, but also like Whip It and, you know, some of the really wonderful stuff about growing up has been older, on the older side. I think about something like, it's not a film a lot of people talk about, but I think about something like Adventureland, which Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart were in, which is, by the way, a terrific movie. It was just, it was kind of sold as a super bad movie, and it's not a super bad movie. Mm-mm. It's a really wonderful, interesting coming of age movie. But again, older teenagers. And I think one thing about this is, how do you tell the story of girls who, when you look at them, they are really young? How do you kind of tell that story in a way that has enough appeal to, like, not just little kids? And I think Hollywood is not necessarily great at making those real middle grade-y kinds of adaptations. I think about stuff like Everything Sucks, which was a show on Netflix that we loved. It's tricky to make those kind of in-between adaptations. And I think when you combine that with Judy Blume's, as Monica was mentioning, protectiveness of Margaret, I think that may be why you didn't see it before now. But what a joy, I think, to see it have an adaptation that is, again, true to the book and yet expands upon the book. Barry, check me on this. Do you agree with me that they kind of round out the character of the mom?
But they give her a... It's not that they give her a backstory. They give her an inner life of her own that is also not heavy. It mirrors to a certain extent what's happening with Margaret, but not in a heavy-handed way.
Right.
Like, it wasn't until I walked away that I was like, oh, her struggles with the PTA are much like her daughter's struggles with her friends. You know what I mean? In fact, I'm thinking of one specific moment where she's, because she's an artist and she's struggling with her relationship to that, where she has this moment where she's feeling inspired, where you really get to see who this woman is as a woman, not in relationship to her child, not in her relationship to plot architecture or her husband. By the way, the husband is darling. He has maybe like four scenes. He's so darling.
And they're a couple. Like they have a built relationship, which I also really liked.
Oh, when he pulls out that chair and sits it down in the living room, I mean, I couldn't stop grinning during this film, you guys. I wanted to hug my family.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Linda mentioned that there aren't necessarily a ton of movies and TV shows that talk about this particular age. And I imagine part of that just comes from the challenges in casting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anytime you're trying to cast somebody who is on the verge of something, you run the risk of the actor crossing that verge
mm-hmm.
in the time that it takes to develop and shoot a movie. And I think they did such a beautiful job with the casting of this film. I did want to ask you guys one of the questions that I kind of had going into this movie, which was, who is it for? Is this movie for kids of this age? Is this an early exercise in nostalgia, you know, like where teenagers would feel nostalgia for the time they were this age? Is this for people like several of us who grew up reading these books? Whom do you feel should be most excited about this film? I'm going to start with you, Monica.
Oh, boy. I did want to give a quick shout out, by the way, to the Gordita Chronicles, because I think it also captures this time.
Oh, what a great grab.
And just that sense of all the changes that are happening and that weird in-between spot in people's lives. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the audience, my goodness, as someone who didn't have nostalgia for these stories, and I immediately, you know, walked out of the screening beaming, I think it is so accessible for multiple people. And I love to hear that, you know, folks are going in groups and people are taking different generations. I think it has the capability of connecting with a lot of different groups.
Whatever the gender of your kids may be, I think you could take kids younger than this.
Absolutely.
You could take kids this age. You could take kids older than this, and they would, I think, have a little bit of that, like, oh, yeah, I remember that. And absolutely, adults.
Date night.
Particularly when you include those lovely performances from Rachel McAdams and Benny Safdie and the great Kathy Bates, who I think inhabits this part of the fun grandma without getting lost in a wacky grandma caricature.
Yes! Such a good way to
put
it.
She's so good.
You know, I'm going to take my 9-year-old to it on Friday as well. And I think the more younger kids see this, actually, there's something normalizing all of the stuff that's happening. So for my youngest, it's going to be like, oh, things are hard for my brother, you know? And also, menstruation exists, you know? I look forward to fielding those questions. But I remember watching Big Mouth and thinking, God, I wish I could watch this with my kids now, which I absolutely emphatically cannot. This is the movie that I wanted, that expressed, that was radical in a lot of ways, but not in the slapsticky, you know, very adult way that Big Mouth is.
Yeah.
One more thing I do want to say, just really shout out to people who are looking for an amazing binge. The old Wonder Years, and the new one is wonderful too, but there's only one series. This reminded me so much of the old Wonder Years, which really, really holds up. There are a couple of episodes that, you know, do feel old-fashioned, but again, because it is set in the 70s, it feels a little more of its time. But again, dealing with a lot of these issues, the triumphs and tragedies that are so huge but may seem minor in a gentle, loving way. Try to get the DVDs, though, because they ruined all the music on Hulu. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Hate when that happens.
The other thing I appreciated about this film as a thing for younger kids, and it's kind of related to what Barry is saying, I like the way that these kids are talking to each other about bodies and sex and things like that. And they have these reactions to things sometimes that are like, I'm sorry, what? And I think, like, even when I was really quite young, I had a kid basically explain to me how sex worked, another small kid. And I remember my reaction was like, what? I was like, why would you do that? And it was the funniest, like, and I think it gets at that kind of, even when you're a little bit older, that bafflement.
Yeah.
And I really liked that. There's a lot of laughing. It's not a matter of the girls all being just like, oh, how horrifying and frightening and all that stuff. There's just a lot of this kind of giggly, like, what? I very much appreciated that about the film.
All right. So we have given people a recommendation for this film. See this film. We've given people a recommendation for 8th grade.
Yes.
Babysitter's Club, Gordita Chronicles, Wonder Years. We've set you on a path full of rich recommendations. Also, bring on the Judy Blume cinematic universe.
Oh, yes. Please do.
I joked with Linda after this was over. I wanted a post-credit sequence kind of setting up forever.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yes, a stinger.
Yeah.
Yes. I love it. I one thing that was so darling is, you know, Judy Blume is actually in this film. She walks by.
Linda and I both pointed.
She does. Yeah, and she, like, she makes eye contact with the camera in this way that kind of made me think, like, it had a Marvel quality to it where she almost breaks the fourth wall where I was like, oh, we are going to get more.
She's the Stan Lee of the JBCU.
Yeah.
We want to know what you think about Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Linda Holmes, Barry Hardiman, Monica Castillo, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, buddy.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Before we go, I did want to say a quick word about our beloved producer, Candace Lim. This is Candace Lim's last episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour, which breaks my heart, but excites me because there is some wonderful, wonderful news yet to be reported.
I cannot tell you how sad I am she's leaving, but how delighted I am that she has a new adventure coming.
Yeah, and boy, it's a good one.
Candace, you rock.
We want to take a moment to thank our Pop Culture Happy Hour Plus subscribers. We appreciate you so much for showing your support of NPR. If you haven't signed up yet, want to show your support and listen to this show without any sponsor breaks, head over to plus.npr.org/happyhour or visit the link in our show notes. This episode was produced by Candace Lim and edited by Jessica Reedy. Hello, Come In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Stephen Thompson, and we will see you all tomorrow.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.